Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the April 13, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. How One Wyoming Mule Deer Won Friends and Influenced Science. Written by Kylie Moore for the Environment Desk at Atlas Obscura. Where the ice is still abundant, these penguins are too. Written by Henry Fountain for the Science section of the April 12 issue of the New York Times. Survivor, the True Meaning of Our National Symbol. Written by Jack E. Davis for the Past is Prologue section of the April-May issue of Smithsonian Magazine. And of course, if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. First up, How One Wyoming Mule Deer Won Friends and Influenced Science. Joe the Deer offered researchers a look into migrations and how long it takes deer to visit a forest after a fire. By Kylie Moore. This piece was originally published in High Country News and appears on the Atlas Obscura website as part of Atlas Obscura's Climate Desk collaboration. Every spring, a herd of more than 1,000 mule deer leaves its winter range in Wyoming's Red Desert in search of bountiful grasses and forbs. Some of the animals travel far, heading north up to 155 miles to the mountain slopes of the Hoback Basin, while others stay closer to home. They reconvene in the fall to ride out the winter in the Red Desert. But one deer, Joe, short for journey, never made it back to the Red Desert this winter. Researchers announced her death in mid-March after her fans kept asking, "Where's Joe?" Although it's hard to pinpoint a cause of death without a biologist immediately at the scene, her collar stopped moving last July. When scientists located it, they also found evidence of bear scavenging. Now they're looking back on her life and discussing just what made this deer so special. How she offered a window into how and why her herd fans out across the Wyoming landscape. Researchers collared Joe in 2018 and in the spring of 2020 introduced her to followers of the Wyoming Migration Initiative, a University of Wyoming-based collaborative of biologists, photographers, mapmakers, and writers studying ungulate migrations. Research monitoring deer in the Hoback Basin started almost a decade earlier, yielding the data necessary to designate a 160-mile, 830,000-acre migratory corridor there. Mule deer populations throughout the state have been declining since the 90s, and researchers are hoping to learn how to better protect and conserve their populations. In 2020, wildlife agency officials estimated that there were 330,700 mule deer in Wyoming, a 31% below the target of 476,600 deer. Other humans followed along as, for years, Joe moved between the Red Desert and the wildflower-dotted slopes of the Gros Ventre Range. Joe's journey from basin to high country took about 4 months and entailed crossing rivers, bounding through sagebrush, raising fawns, and avoiding highways, energy development, and fences. YouTube videos and social media posts chronicled her travels, and followers often left comments writing things like, "Thanks for making it possible for us to travel along with Joe," and "Safe travels." Reactions to Joe's death ranged from disappointment, bummer, she provided great intel and was fun to follow, to emotional, "Rest in peace, sweet girl. May your offspring flourish in this place we all love." And matter of fact, "And so nature goes." Her story is done, but her legacy will continue, and so will the research, said Anna Ortega, a PhD candidate at the University of Wyoming. Joe, an excellent representative of the herd's long-distance migrants, gave Ortega and her colleagues a unique opportunity to study ungulate movement post-wildfire. Celebrity animals like Joe are also a powerful way to pique interest in migrations. It's more likely that someone will be invested in, say, Joe the deer, than several thousand animals moving, said Kristen Barker, a PhD candidate at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies elk in Wyoming. It helps people connect more personally to something that would otherwise be abstract. Barker herself was not involved in the Red Desert Mule Deer research. A few months after Joe was born, lightning ignited the Cliff Creek fire, which burned over 20,000 acres. Ortega found that the deer in Joe's herd avoided the dense conifer forest before the fire, perhaps because a lack of sunlight means fewer plants to eat. But afterward, Joe and others swept into the area, drawn by the lush new plant growth. That suggests that wildfire does open up habitat that was once unfavored by mule deer or elk, Ortega said. Joe raised several fawns on the vegetation that sprang up post-fire. Ortega is learning that where and how rapidly ungulates return to a burn scar is determined in part by burn severity. The animals tend to avoid extremely scorched areas at first, preferring places that experienced less intense fire activity, since they have the forage deer need. But after a year or two, once plants start to regrow in badly burned areas, ungulates flock to them again. Joe's own journey added context to the movements of the greater herd. When you look more closely at the individual level, you get a more nuanced understanding of how animals actively perceive and respond to their environment, Barker said. Joe's herd showed researchers that migration is key to survival, even when the distance traveled varies. The thought that migration diversity exists because there are some trade-offs in survival and reproduction, Ortega said. It's similar to not putting all your eggs in one basket. For example, deer that travel longer distances gain more fat over the growing season, but deer that migrate medium and shorter distances are more likely to see their fawns survive to fall. One animal, known as Deer 255, wowed researchers with her record-setting migration, 242 miles one way, the longest documented land migration in the lower 48. She helped set the upper bounds of the herd's migration, but did not serve as the best proxy for understanding the majority. Most deer travel far, but not that far. We haven't captured anybody like her, Ortega said. She's an anomaly and an outlier, but when we look at Joe, she's representative of all the long-distance migrants. Although Joe's journey ended last summer, others will soon begin. Spring is coming, snow is melting, plants are emerging, and within the next month, researchers will be watching to see where the next generation of mule deer go. Where the ice is still abundant, these penguins are too. by Henry Fountain for the Science section of the April 12 issue of the New York Times. Adelie penguins have had a rough time of it on the western side of the Antarctic Peninsula, where warming, linked to climate change, has occurred faster than almost anywhere else on the planet. That and other factors have led to sharp declines in Adelie populations in recent decades. But on the eastern side, it's a different story. "It's just a complete train wreck on the western side of the peninsula," said Heather J. Lynch, a statistical ecologist at Stony Brook University who studies penguin populations and how they're changing. "But on the eastern side, the populations are stable and quite healthy." Dr. Lynch uses satellite imagery in much of her work, but also organizes penguin surveying expeditions to the peninsula, the northernmost part of the Antarctic continent. On the latest one, in January, three of her current and former doctoral students did the counting at islands on the eastern side of the peninsula in the Weddell Sea. Their work showed that Adelie populations there have changed little since previous counts taken over the last two decades. That suggests that as global warming continues and Adelie populations decline in other parts of the continent, the Weddell may remain an important refuge for the birds. "It's a nice confirmation that where the climate has not changed as dramatically, the populations have not changed dramatically," Dr. Lynch said. The Weddell Sea is notoriously icy, a function of a rotating current, or gyre, that keeps much of the pack ice within the sea for years. The ice makes it difficult for most ships to navigate. The Weddell is where the explorer Ernest Shackleton's ship Endurance was crushed by ice a century ago. That wreck was found last month. Over the years, Dr. Lynch's students have done penguin surveys from, quote, ships of opportunity, often sailing on cruise ships in return for giving lectures and otherwise helping out. On the Antarctic Peninsula, those ships usually stay on the western side, and regulations limit shore visits to a very specific set of colonies. The January trip was aboard a Greenpeace vessel that ventured around the tip of the peninsula into the northwestern Weddell. "It's somewhere that we've wanted to get to," Dr. Lynch said. "A lot of these colonies have not been visited in a very long time, if ever." The three researchers, Michael Wethington, Claire Flynn, and Alex Borowitz, used drones and hand counting to determine the number of chicks at colonies on Joinville, Vortex, Devil, and other islands. "Hand counting takes time," said Ms. Flynn, a first-year doctoral student at Stony Brook. "Counters identify a specific area within a colony, perhaps a grouping of nests or an area delineated by the birds' walking paths, and count all the chicks within it three times to ensure accuracy. At Penguin Point, a particularly sprawling colony on Seymour Island that's home to 21,500 chicks, the counting took 2 days. Adelies normally produce 2 chicks per breeding pair each year." "It does get tedious counting them 3 times over," Ms. Flynn said, "but it's such an amazing place to be and such an amazing job to be doing." "And the birds can be entertaining," she said, "like when a hungry chick furiously chases after a parent demanding food." Adelies are among the most numerous of the penguin species found in Antarctica, with an estimated 3.8 million breeding pairs at colonies all around the continent. They use their beaks to gather small stones to make nests on dry land. Chicks hatch around November, late in the southern hemisphere spring, and the parents take turns guarding them and foraging for food that they then regurgitate for their offspring. Antarctic Peninsula adelies are choosy about their diet. They eat only krill, a small crustacean, although elsewhere they also eat fish. Krill and ice, or the lack of both, are at the root of the adelies' problems on the western side of the peninsula, which has been warming as a result of atmospheric circulation patterns originating in the warming tropics. Krill flourish in cold, icy conditions, so as warming has caused sea ice to decline, krill have become less abundant as well. That leaves adelies without enough of the food they need for themselves and their chicks. The fact that there are such picky eaters on the peninsula is to their detriment because they're very much tied to the health of the krill population, Dr. Lynch said. Populations have declined by as much as 90% in some parts of the western side, and Gentoo penguins, distinguishable by their bright orange beaks, have largely taken over. "They'll eat anything. They'll breed anywhere," Dr. Lynch said of the Gentoos. "I think of them like the urban pests of the peninsula," she said. As the world continues to warm, models suggest that the Weddell and the Ross Sea in West Antarctica will be the last places to become unfavorable to adelies. The Weddell has also been proposed as a marine protected area under the Antarctic Treaty, which would further protect the penguins and other life there from human activities like krill fishing, especially as cover declines from warming and the area becomes more accessible. "As scientists, we want to map out where all the important biology is for that effort," Dr. Lynch said. The finding that populations are stable, quote, "doesn't mean that climate change isn't happening in the Weddell Sea," she said. "It just means that by virtue of the oceanography, it remains cold and icy and exactly the kind of place where these adelies need to live." Survivor, the true meaning of our national symbol. Written by Jack E. Davis. In a letter to his daughter, not long after the United States won its independence, Benjamin Franklin branded the bald eagle a, quote, "bird of bad moral character." He wished, he wrote, that it, quote, "had not been chosen as the representative of our country." Many believe that he also lobbied for the turkey as national bird. That is not true, however. In fact, Congress has never chosen a national bird, as it has a national mammal, the bison, and a national tree, the oak. What the Continental Congress did was put the bald eagle on the Great Seal of the United States in 1782. Long venerated by native cultures, this bird lives only in North America, a distinction that suited a young republic eager to assert an American-born identity separate from Europe. Ever since, the bald eagle has reigned as a symbol of national unity and strength. Despite Franklin's views, Americans immediately began displaying its image in public ceremonies and on organizational regalia, yet they simultaneously targeted the living bird for eradication, as they did other predators such as wolves and coyotes. Throughout the 19th century and beyond, an eagle seen was an eagle to be shot. Newspapers, government officials, and ornithologists wrongfully accused the species, which primarily eats fish, of carrying away sheep, calves, and pigs, livestock that exceed its lifting power. Detractors even cautioned mothers that the white-headed raptors kidnapped babies. Quote, "For sad to relate," the New York Sun wrote in 1905, The original of our national emblem is a scavenger, a coward, and a thief. Once a fixture across the country, the persecuted bird began disappearing from an increasing number of states. Of the millions of people who daily see our national emblem on the coins and arms of our country, Nature magazine noted in 1923, a very large proportion have never seen an American eagle in the sky. In 1940, a year before declaring war against fascist tyranny, Congress passed the Bald Eagle Protection Act to preserve, quote, a symbol of the American ideals of freedom. Harming an eagle now brought fines and a prison sentence. Yet 5 years later, when eagles were poised for recovery, DDT became available for general use. Collateral victims of the pesticide's widespread application included countless fish and birds, and by 1963, the bald eagle's nesting population in the contiguous United States had fallen to a despairing 487 pairs, far fewer than what a single state would have hosted before the Revolution. At the same time, Americans had fouled their own nest. Biocides tainted their food, factory and automobile exhaust their air, and waste products their water. Recognizing that their quality of life, even survival, depended on the same healthy environment that non-human species required, 20 million Americans nationwide participated in cleanup and tree planting campaigns and protest marches on the first Earth Day, April 22, 1970. Congress responded in swift order with a series of landmark environmental laws, including the Clean Air Act and Endangered Species Act. In just 1 year, 1972, the EPA banned the use of DDT. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service imposed harsher penalties for harming eagles, and Congress gave decisive bipartisan support to the Clean Water Act. Marking its 50th anniversary this October, the CWA initiated the revitalization of our rivers, lakes, and coastal waters, the majority of which were unsafe for fishing and swimming. Nothing could be more essential to the eagles' comeback than the Clean Water Act restoring their watery habitats. Although the number of nesting pairs was inching upward, eagles were among the first species to land on the endangered species list in 1974. 2 years later, during the nation's bicentennial, Fish and Wildlife launched initiatives to reintroduce eagles to revitalized environments, counting on their domestic instincts to advance their recovery. Couples mate for life, return to the same nest every breeding season, and nurture their young, typically two, with such care that by the time they leave the nest, juveniles often outweigh their parents. Having elevated their breeding population in the lower 48 to more than 6,000, bald eagles were ready to come off the endangered species list in 1999. Bureaucratic inertia delayed delisting until 2007. While more than a third of the world's national animals, from India's tigers to Tanzania's Maasai giraffes, are endangered, bald eagles are thriving. During the 2010s, their population quadrupled, reaching roughly 300,000 in the contiguous U.S., equivalent to the estimated number in the 18th century. America's bird has become a symbol of a society that has forged a wiser balance with nature and a more secure future for humankind. Thank you for joining us for the April 13, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. I'm Karen Wheeler.